Six music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week's guest is a vocalist whose musical output has evolved from the dance, pop and electro-funk of her early band Moloco into a remarkably inventive solo performer whose albums encapsulate house, disco, smoky jazz and almost avant-garde electronica. And she's got the most amazing voice. My guest on The First Time this week is Rasheen Murphy. Here Roisin recalls a very musical upbringing as a child in Ireland, and the huge impact of moving to Manchester and then to Sheffield, moves that introduced her to alternative music and opened up a whole new world of creativity. She also speaks about her passion for dance music, starting with her relationship with Sheffield's DJ Parrot, who's remained a key influence, and her first memories of forming Moloco and the band's breakthrough success with huge hits like Bring It Back. Also, she chooses some incredible music by people like Sonic Youth, The Stone Roses and Van Morrison, and discusses her solo career, first meeting groundbreaking producer Matthew Herbert, and her current album, Hairless Toys. But I started by asking, as I do with all my guests, when was Roisin first aware of music?
I was actually lucky enough to be pretty much surrounded by music growing up, and people in the family who were in bands and musicians and things, and even people who weren't even musical would sing all the bloody time. So when there was ever a drink, which was quite often, there was always music.
What sort of thing?
Well, you know, not really traditional Irish music, actually, in our little kind of world. I'm from a place called Arklow. My uncle was a very famous, in our part of Ireland, jazz musician and kind of all-round sort of band man. He had several bands. He was always a band leader. He was pitch perfect, absolute genius, played everything, sang like a dream. And I grew up in the summertime going to see his jazz band every Sunday. So they'd have like an all-dayer where they just played for hours and hours and hours in this pub in the countryside. And all the kids would be there and all the adults would be there and everybody would be there. And then they'd all come back and they'd have a big party, and they partied harder than any of my generation have done, you know. The music that I was hearing was sort of American music, was jazz music, was rock and roll, was songbook music. That was the kind of songs that my family sang when they sat around and sang at each other, which they did very regularly. My dad has a lovely voice and is always singing too. And, well, he has very long baths very occasionally. And, you know, he's in the bath for 2 hours with a bottle of wine and sings at the top of his voice and speaks about the songs in between the songs and pretends, you know, he's in this total fantasy land that he's on stage. Should have been on the stage, my father, but however.
Name a song you sang.
Lots of Frank Sinatra songs. Yeah, kind of more of American songbook type songs, but yeah, Strangers in the Night, things like that, you know.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night. What were the chances we'd be sharing love before the night was through?
What was the first record that you owned?
The first single I had that was mine was The Tide Is High by Blondie, actually.
Very good start.
But I didn't buy it. I was given it by my aunt, who had a fish and chip shop kind of place with a jukebox. So we used to get the 7 inches when they came out of the jukebox, when they stopped playing them. So I used to get 7 inches off her, and that was the first one I got.
It was a great sounding record still.
It's a fantastic record, yeah. I didn't even know what reggae was, you know, and something about that rhythm so sort of exotic and unplaceable when you don't know anything about that kind of music. And yet it was such a pop record, you know.
Teasing her, me bad, but it's the way you do the things you do to me. Were you quite obsessed with music at that early age, or was it just something
you
enjoyed?
Yeah, I think I was. You know, I mean, we're talking very early age there, 10 or 11. I think I was, yeah. I think I really did respond to music. I remember playing my mother's 7-inch of Ticket to Ride over and over and over and over and over again as a sort of 7-year-old, you know. So I was, and I did respond to my mother's record collection quite intensely as a very young child, yeah. I could really go in, you know. I can really go in to what I'm hearing.
When did you first realise you could sing?
Not till sort of I was about 9 or 10, and my mum went off on holiday with her girlfriends. And in the meantime, I learned to sing Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, for her as a gift when she came back.
Don't cry for me, Argentina.
And that's so well, sweet. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. I remember it vividly, their mouths dropping open, and then, you know, my grandmother was there, my aunt was there, my mother was there, my father was there, my Uncle Jim was there, and them kind of going, oh my goodness, she can sing, you know. And then it was just torture from then on in. Every time they had a drink, it's like, sing, go and cry for Acca One, your nana will be dead this time next year. She could be dead any time, she could die any time, please sing it. Like, I'll be running down the street away from all these mad relatives begging me to sing it. Put me off singing for a while, actually.
What were your first impressions when you moved to Manchester then?
It was very liberating to go to Manchester.
12 years
yeah,
old, something like that?
Yeah. Okay. It was a massive eye-opener, obviously. I came from a small town. I used to go and spend, like, hours in Debenhams trying on fishtail cocktail dresses and stuff like that, you know, things that you just didn't come across in Arklow, you know.
Is that where you went to your first gigs?
Yes, when I got a bit older, when I was 14. Well, no, the first gig I went to was in Ireland, was Queen. I went there with my dad and my brother at Slane Castle.
What do you remember from that?
Well, we were all mad about Queen, actually. The family were crazy about it. But I don't remember it really having such a great impact on me because it was such a big place, and I'm kind of still have a bit of an issue with very, very big gigs, you know. I like a bit of intimacy.
Is there a Queen song we should play at this juncture for you and your family?
I would like another one, Bites the Dust, please, love.
Ugh. another one busts the dust. Hey, hey, another one busts the dust. Hey.
And then from Manchester to Sheffield, you've referred back to it a fair few times over the space of your
sure.
career. What is it about when you first moved there? Could you feel a different evolving, I guess?
Well, sure. In a big city, you're able to sort of hide in plain sight. Do you know what I mean? You're able to kind of find your type of people to surround yourself with. And I discovered when I was about 14 that my type of people were kind of a little unusual. And into music and into reading books and kind of, you know, I started going to gigs, and the first one of which was Sonic Youth, and it changed my outlook completely.
Why?
It just gave me a focus. It gave me something to believe in, you know. It was like finding a religion, in a sense. You know, I think for a lot of young people, music can do that. I started to collect records and I started to go to lots of gigs. I started to have a real meaning for me, you know, music did. And it helped shape my identity as something other than the mainstream. I didn't have to fit in anymore. I could fit out, you know, and that was extremely liberating and very powerful and gave me a lot of strength.
We'll be right back.
You mentioned in the list of people that have kind of made impact on you, talking about Sheffield, DJ Parrott.
There are several people in Sheffield that had a massive impact on me. Winston Hazel being one of the DJ. Of course, Mark Bryden, who I worked with in Maloko. Total Don as well. But Parrott, I've worked with on and off for the last few years since I left Sheffield. And he keeps me kind of grounded to what I learned in Sheffield in that sense. So even on Overpowered, you know, I worked with him a little bit on Overpowered, some of the tracks. But I also sent him the tracks for him to kind of listen to as I was going along, and it was someone to talk to, and it kept me in that sort of grounded zone where I wasn't, you know, losing the run of myself, as they say in Ireland. He's the kind of producer, like the best producers, really, I think, are the ones that cut out all the guff. They go straight to the point. They know exactly what they want to achieve or what they can achieve, and they don't waste their time with what they can't achieve. And so it can seem quite a cold way of working, but somehow it's usually that kind of producer that gets the soul out of the music, you know, that
digs into it.
Really is very focused. It's a very focused sort of light that goes on there. And it's a real buzz working with Parrott for that reason.
You all right? You can do it? Beautiful.
Sheffield outfit The All-Seeing Eye with their 1998 hit Beat Goes On, featuring Sheffield dance music hero DJ Parrot. A huge impact on my guest here on the First Sun this week, Roisin Murphy.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music.
6 Music.
Everett, and this is the first time on 6 Music where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Roisin Murphy, and that song was, of course, I Want to Be Adored by the Stone Roses, Manchester icons. And it was that city that provided the backdrop for Roisin's conversion from indie to first discovering dance music.
What was your dance floor, the masked moment? When did you first fall in love with dance music?
Well, as I said, when I was in Manchester, I sort of surrounded myself with these kind of weirdos, I suppose people would call them, you know, with the long hair and black clothes and whatnot. And we were into Sonic Youth and Sub Pop records and definitely sort of Jesus and Mary Chain, and also into 60s music like The Stooges and, you know, anything cool. Really. And there was a club that played all that kind of music, and it was called Isadora's. And then one week they were playing the Stone Roses, and then the next week there was a gang of lads in that weren't weirdos, and they were all dancing with us. And then it sort of started to evolve where the things magically started to bleed into each other, you know. And then you just find yourself at the Hacienda, or you find yourself at a club that's playing acid house, and it just is a very natural thing in those days for those things to kind of meld together. I mean, I guess more so until I got to Sheffield in Manchester. I was more into black music, I was more into hip hop and R&B and funk and things like that, and those were the kind of clubs that I frequented most. Those are the kind of places where I learned to dance.
What would be a key record from that era?
Key record from that era would be an En Vogue record. And I guess Young MC, Bust a Move.
Amazing song.
Top stuff. Bust it.
Bye.
here's a chant for all the fellas. Try to do what those ladies tell us. Get shot down cause you're overzealous. Play hard to get females, get jealous. Okay, smarty, go to a party. Girls are scantily clad, are showing body. A chick walks by, you wish you could sex her, but you're standing on the wall like you was Poindexter. Next day's function, high class luncheon. Food is served and you're stone cold munching. Music comes on, people start to dance, but then you ate so much you nearly split your pants. A girl starts walking, guys start gawking. Sits down next to you and starts talking. Says she wanna dance cause she likes the groove. So come on, fatso, and just bust the move. Someone could cure your lonely condition. Looking for love in all the wrong places. No fine girls, just ugly faces. From frustration, first inclination is to become a monk and leave the situation. But every dark tunnel has a light of hope. So don't hang yourself with a celibate rope. New movie showing, so you're going. Could care less about the five you're blowing. Theater gets dark just to start the show. Then you spot a fine woman sitting in your row. She's dressed in yellow, she says hello. Come sit next to me, you fine fellow. You run over there without a second to lose. And what comes next? Hey, bust a move. Some play, then you try to make a move and she says no way. Girls are faking, goodness saking. They want a man who brings home the bacon. Got no money and you got no car, then you got no woman, and there you are. Some girls are sadistic, materialistic. Looking for a man makes them opportunistic. They're lying on the beach perpetrating a tan so that a brother with money can be their man. So on the beach you're strolling, real high rolling. Everything you have is yours and not stolen. A girl runs up with something to prove, so don't just stand there and bust the move.
What was the very first Moloko release?
Where is the what of the what is and why?
What do you remember about recording that track? Because it seems that it was, on your part anyway, not enormously studied. It wasn't part of a big strategy to become the singer of
an act. Well, you saw right there. I mean, that really was. It was just messing about, really, to start with. The first tracks that we recorded were Party Weirdo, which is on that album, and that was really more just acting than singing. And well, you know, I just sort of put myself in the method of being some kind of freaked out valley girl, LA, kind of just chatting, basically the stream of consciousness nonsense sort of thing, and very little singing. There was a full length version of Do You Like My Tight Sweater, See How It Fits My Body track, which was just me saying that over and over again. Things like that. We got signed on the basis of making those kinds of tracks. So we got signed and nobody knew I could sing. And there was an American guy in the record label, thank God, because everybody else was lovely, nice, shy English people. But he was a big, brash American. And he was like, sat us down in the chair one time in the office and was like, she can sing, she can definitely sing. We were like... I can't really. And he's like, listen to this. And he goes, tiny bit of singing, and he played it over and over again to us. He's going, that shit's like Nina Simone, man. And we were really embarrassed at this point. But, you know, he really forced the issue, and I went back and tried to do a bit of singing, and we took it from there. And everything about Moloko was like that. Everything was just one step at a time. Like, taking the thing into the live arena, that was like, we'd made a whole album, just the two of us, in a studio. We didn't envisage ever doing a live thing. And then we did finally do a live thing. You know, it was kind of always like that. Every part of it.
People have got a great fondness for that first record. How do you feel about it now?
I think it's a really good record. I really do. There's a magic about it because it's me and him falling in love with each other, for a start off, and you're finding a kind of a soulmate. And not just that, but also a reason for living. You know, this is what I'm here for.
That's
you know, this
to
is.
Say.
This is what I was sort of waiting around on the dole for all these years. Wow. You know.
Out of bed I was dreaming. I was wired 2 o'clock. I tickle by the minute hand. Tick tock, tick, tick tock. I dream I'm on a train. And it is making music. I don't remember getting on. Clickety click, clickety click. I dreamt that I was very tall. I was bigger than King Kong. I heard the bells are ringing, a ding dong, a ding dong. I dream that I am sitting in the devil's company. He gave a sign of promise, faithful for me.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
We have to talk about Sing It Back. If you're talking about special records, talking about records that change things for you. How did it feel when the remix of that song just went stratospheric, he said, in music journalist lingo?
It didn't feel stratospheric at the time. It just felt sort of, yeah, it did. It did, I suppose, feel. It felt like a hit. Yeah, we'd had a hit. And but it felt like, oh, God, now we've got to have another one. And how are we going to do that? And this was a remix. And so there was a lot of mixed feelings about it.
Did you resent it a little bit at the time?
I don't think I resented it, but it was tricky.
Go on.
It's like we haven't got 10 Sing It Backs to play at Glastonbury. It was tricky. It wasn't that easy.
How do you feel about it now?
I don't think it's one of my best. I really don't. But, you know, who am I to tell? It's all right. It's all right.
First thinking, this is as far as I want to go under the Moloko banner.
Never felt that. You know, it was really, I had no choice. We were girlfriend and boyfriend. All of a sudden, we weren't. We made another record, barely got through it. It's an album called Statues. And
do you mean barely got through it? It was just...
Well, you know, we'd broken up. There was a lot of raw feelings. It was very tricky. It was tricky. And I didn't want to not do Moloko, but it just wasn't anymore on the cards. So I was really scared that I couldn't do it without my boyfriend holding my hand, you know. And he taught me pretty much everything. And then I had no idea how I was going to go forward.
How did you go forward?
Matthew Herbert held my hand instead, which was good.
Where did you first meet him? Because he produced the first solo record.
I first met Matthew years ago at a nightclub called The End, after he'd done a remix for us of Sing It Back, which I absolutely love. He said to me that night, you know what, we should do a record together. And this was years before we'd broke up. And I said, yes, I'd absolutely love to do that, and just kept it in my mind. The first day I went in, it all just started to click immediately.
Straight away?
Yeah. And he was just a wonderful ally to have. And I couldn't have picked better, in fact, I think, because he made a record that was all about me, you know. It was even down to, you know, I remember going in the first day, I went in and I had an article about Brian Eno, you know, thinking that we could have a little chat about that. And I said, he's interested in it, here's an article. And he went, yeah, can you just hit that across the microphone, that magazine? And I went, all right then. So I started hitting them, made a piece of music out of an article about Brian Eno. He had this appreciation for sound. Obviously, I mean, that is the way he works. He's listening to everything, listening to how his feet sound on the carpet, you know, wondering whether he should sample it. That made him listen to my voice in a way that was very encouraging for me, because he heard it as something very beautiful. And that was great for me.
If there's a track that he has a credit on, what should we play at this juncture?
I think you could play anything off Around the House, which was an incredible album by Matthew.
Thank you. record. Hella's Toys. You recorded a lot of material for this before you've honed it down to the tracks on the record, yeah?
Yes, we've recorded several albums worth. Jesus, we have to be stopped. He's someone I've known so long now as well, you know. Eddie Stevens, who I work with. I've never really started to make an album from scratch with anyone I've known as well as I know him. He's the musical director of all of my live shows since sort of the beginning, really, and he's like a brother, and we were just able to just mainline straight into productivity and just got on with it, basically, and it was, yeah, very, very prolific. It's a free piece of music, freely made, and we weren't particularly trying to have any particular style.
Are you getting stranger? Do you think your music's getting more esoteric?
I can do both. My voice fits to both. My creativity fits to both sides. But as far as, you know, chasing the pop charts, you know, it's not something I'm interested in right now.
If you'd let me hold me, this is a soul.
Final thing is, we ask you to pick the last song. It can be anything you want. Something of yours, something of someone else's, something you've loved.
I tell you what you can play is you can play The Streets of Arklow by Van Morrison.
Why that song?
Because it's about my town, and also it's totally beautiful. It really is gorgeous.
It's been good to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And as we walk down the streets of Arklow, and I hear
in the morning. I'm coming on to dawn. And as we walk through the streets of our clothes, in gay profusion, in God's green. Gypsy road with our hearts on fire. They say we love to wander. Lord, we love, Lord, we love to roam. And as we the grass didn't grow. And our souls were clean. Yeah, the grass didn't grow. The grass didn't grow.
BBC Radio 6 Music. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the very best of Glastonbury on BBC Radio 6 Music.
Don't seem to have a jingle, but love.